Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to convene the what is scheduled to be the final meeting of the Labor and Consumer Protection Division for this biennium. In honor of that, Ms. Murphy has been good enough yet again to bake for us. So for members, staff, and pages, at least, there are cookies, two different kinds?
Peanut butter
and apparently only Representative Mahoney gets the oatmeal chocolate chip. I had dairy farmers in my office this week, not constituents, I'll point out. And so there is milk, because I've been in a very dairy mood all week since then. There's milk to go with the cookies. Thank you. Ms. Murphy. First bill on the agenda, since we do have a quorum, is House File 3076, Representative Junkie. Year two on man lifts, if I recall correctly. The chair would like to move House File 3076 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and we referred to
Commerce and Labor,
of course. Representative Junkie, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You might remember this from last year. There was a bill that came through on elevator regulation. At that time, we ran into a little snag, I think, with rural man lifts and elevators and with small rural and small churches anywhere. And so the committee, in their wisdom, asked the department and others, and you see the department coming to the table, to go back and work with these groups and hopefully put together a compromise that everyone can live with. They have done that. The product is in front of you. As far as I know, everyone supports it. I've had no one come into my office against it, including the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, who's here if you have any questions, but I won't ask them to testify unless need be. So, but Mr. Joachim's here from the department, and he can give you a brief update on what's occurred.
Mr. Joachim, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. Representative Junkie gave you a brief outline of what we've gone through. What this bill does is the following. We wanted to clarify one of the things that happened inadvertently when we added in the exemptions last year was we exempted out all new installation inspections, and that was never intended. So this puts back in the requirement that all new devices, wherever they are located, will require permit inspection by the department and or City of St. Paul, Minneapolis. We established three levels of elevator inspection timelines for the periodic inspections. We have a five-year inspection timeline on the special purpose elevators, a three-year timeline on churches without attached school facilities, so that the smaller churches that has the mom and pop that use the lift device or the elevator on Sunday or Saturday, those will be on a three-year timeline of inspections. And then all other devices, the escalators and elevators that are in buildings that are highly populated, will be inspected once a year. We established tried to arrange how to address the operating fee, so the $100 operating fee applies to all, and it still balances out. If you have a three-year inspection, it's about $300. That's about what our inspection fee would be if we did a one-time inspection. So it's easier for us to document things, to do it $100 every year rather than issue it on a time inspection criteria. And then one of the concerns that the Grain and Feed Elevator Associations had was the hand-powered man lifts in their elevators, in their grain elevators, and the electric single-person lift. And so we exempt them out of the periodic inspections. They are required to comply with the OSHA inspections, and I've checked with our OSHA staff, and if there is any issue that comes up on one of those devices, they can call us, our elevator inspectors, in to provide them some assistance to verify the safety devices on those equipment if they find one that isn't functioning properly.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Joachim. I have on the list a Mr. Brad Bergstresser wishing to testify on House File 3076. That's the next? It kind of ran together. Mr. Bergstresser, if you're here, relax. That wasn't for you. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 3076 on man lifts? Seeing that, any questions from the committee? With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 3076 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Junkie, always a pleasure.
Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner, House File 2402. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I have an author's amendment, too.
You do. The chair will move that House File 2402 be before the committee, recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. What is the number for the 2402A3 amendment? Is that the one you're referring to, Representative Gardner?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move the 2402A3 amendment to get the bill in the order the author prefers. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, we've had a highly successful system for recovering lead acid batteries for cars and other vehicles for about 20 years. This bill would bring it more current with the times. When you buy a new battery, a lead acid battery, at a battery retailer, you bring in your old one free of charge. If you don't bring it in, you're charged $5. So there's an obvious incentive that you bring in your old one so that it's recovered, it doesn't enter the environment, it doesn't end up in a scrapyard, and the lead acid battery manufacturer can use it as raw materials for making new batteries. So it's been a highly successful system for approximately 20 years. However, state law says that if you do not bring in your old battery, the state law says you have to be charged $5. Battery manufacturers are now charging roughly $10. So now our battery retailers in Minnesota are being shorted by about $5 when people don't bring in their old battery. I do have a testifier here who's a battery retailer who can tell you how this works. We tried to get Michael Waltrip, you know, it's his last year, you know, racing was the Napa guy. Well, never mind. I don't think you're going to be Napa. Okay, well.
Wrong demographic, sorry.
Sorry.
I'm willing to guess you're Mr. Bergstresser.
Yes, I am.
Outstanding. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Brad Bergstresser. I'm with NAP Auto Parts in Burnsville, Minnesota. First, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for considering this bill. It does have a definite impact on our business, and we appreciate Representative Gardner for entering this bill for consideration. A little past history, before this became law, there was a system in place in our industry. Most of the battery manufacturers were charging a charge for the old battery, which we referred to as a core charge. And the reason for that is that there are materials that the battery manufacturers do want to recycle and recover. In 1989, when this law was first passed, I believe what we were charging was $4 to the consumer for the core charge, or for what we called the surcharge. So this was not a big impact to us at the time when the law required that we charge $5. But as Representative Gardner pointed out, when we do sell a battery and there's not an exchange at the time of sale, or if the consumer does not bring the battery back to us later, that battery is actually costing us more than what we are charging. So I believe this is good legislation because it will cover our costs if the battery is not returned to us for recycling. And I think it's additional encouragement for the consumer to bring the battery back.
Okay. Simple enough.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the author or the testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 2402? Do we see movement? No, we do not. Yeah?
I would be surprised if Mr. Johnson had anything.
I would have been too, but, you know, you never know. All right. No, he's very clear. All right. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 2402 is amended, be recommended pass, and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Enjoy your milk.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a cookies and milk recess. We're out getting authors, and as soon as the authors show up, We will reconvene. Hopefully that will be brief, but we're temporarily in recess. Thank you. Absolutely. Okay.
She is in 400 South.
Yeah. You probably have to be here.
That's enough, but no cookies. There's, peanut butter and then almond.
You
did?
Yeah. I recommend making a photo plan. Yeah. You know what's so funny is I did.
She just got him.
But she's after Tal. So
my parents would buy literally from 7 to 8 pounds at a time. And this is about the storage for the team.
We've got a small
I haven't looked at the calendar, but
small
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Committee can reconvene. It's good of you to walk, bike, motorcycle, or drive this morning, Representative Tao.
Sorry, I was meeting with my plumber.
Meeting with your plumber. Okay, yeah. Good enough. Representative Lilly, would you be good enough to move House File 3297 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Tao, to your bill, sir.
Yep. Thank you, committee. Sorry, a little late. Got, you know, two jobs and stuff, what have you. Anyway, 3297... what they'll do is require the Department of Labor to include data regarding the race and ethnicity of the workers injured in the workplace as part of their program of occupational safety and health statistics. Nationally, the share of foreign-born employment increased by 22% from 96 to 2000. However, the share of fatal occupational injuries for this population increased by 43%. This increase in fatal work injuries among foreign-born workers occurred at a time when the overall number of fatal occupational injuries to U.S. workers declined by 5%. Foreign-born workers disproportionately experience work-related injuries, even as fatal occupational injuries to all U.S. workers have declined. It is highly likely there's a correlation between national and state trends. However, due to a lack of data, we're unable to determine if this is indeed the case. And the goal of this legislation is to determine whether Minnesota is experiencing a disproportionate number of work-related injuries among our immigrant and refugee population so we can address the root of this problem. Currently, essentially what's going to happen is if this bill passed, there's this first report of injury form that if, you know, there's an injury, they fill this form and send it into the department. And on it, we would add another line, another box with the race and ethnicity on it. Right now, we collect gender, marital status, time of the injury and what have you, the name and social security and all of this stuff. So this would do that. And having a conversation with Senator Torres Ray, there's one of the concern is maybe many of the foreign-born workers are not fully trained. That's probably why they might be, the speculation is they're injured more in the workplace, and so we want to look at the data and see if there's something could be done to address. So,
right. Thank you, Representative Tao. I have on the list a Dr. Bruce P. Corey. Dr. Corey, are you in the audience?
I know Dr. Corey, but I don't see Dr. Corey. So,
all right.
He's a good man.
Okay, and so he would be in favor of your bill?
Yeah, I assume so.
Thank you, Representative Tao. Commissioner, are you here to... Okay, different bill. All right. Is there anyone in the audience other than Dr. Corey wishing to testify for or against House File 3297?
The commissioner is also a good man.
Okay. So, yeah, very good. Seeing none, Representative Lilly renews his motion that House File 3297 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tao. Take some cookies and milk with you, sir. There's milk in the box. Cookies are around.
One of each. Not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay.
I haven't been able to find the oatmeal ones in here. I've touched them all, and there's no oatmeal.
The committee descends into that conversation, Representative Clark, are you in the room? There you are. Good morning. Representative Mahoney, would you like to move House File 3293?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would. And I'm not entirely sure where it goes to at this particular point. Back to Commerce?
Yes, sir. Yes. So, okay. Representative Mahoney moves that House File 3293 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Chair Clark, I understand there are three amendments to this bill at this time?
There's two that are in writing, and I think one the council has put... We'll give us.
They're all typed.
Efficient staff.
The amazing Liz Newman. With that, Representative Mahoney moves the H3293A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney moves the H3293A2 amendment to be before the committee.
You don't have it?
Oh, we'll slow down then. I'm sorry. I thought they were in the members' packets. I think we've sent the pages elsewhere. Representative Murdoch, do you have the H3293A1 amendment?
Yes, sir.
You do. Okay, so we do not need to redo the motion related to that one. Okay.
They should have.
Okay. All right. And Representative Clark, all these amendments are amendments you wish to have on the bill to put it in the order you prefer.
They would put the bill in the form that I would like to have it considered in. Thank you. It's part of the process of making sure that we had all the little pieces put together, and it's just taken until the last minute, so I apologize for that, but it should be a non-controversial bill at this point.
You've clearly been working.
Yes.
Thank you. I've actually got these, so yes. Thank you. Oh, you're the amazing Ms. Newman. Don't get coffee, don't do windows, is that what I'm hearing? All right. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Does everyone now have the H3293A2 amendment in their possession?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. And you do it well, Representative Sanders. With that, Representative Mahoney moves the H3293A2 amendment to be before the committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Does everyone have possession of the H3293A3 amendment? Representative Sanders?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Representative Mahoney moves the H3293A3 amendment to be before the committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So your bill is amended. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. I really appreciate putting it in these forms. These were some changes that were brought to us. Actually, just clarifies what we thought we were already doing, and which is we're embedding the Federal Environmental Protection Agency rule regarding lead in the state building code, where the language that has to do with construction and modification, cleaning up, remodeling performed on any residential property or child-occupied facility that's constructed prior to 1978 when the law changed. And what we're doing here is complying with the Federal Code of Regulations, which really is protective of both workers and children in a way that we really want to see in Minnesota law. So we're adopting the Federal Code, which is required already, but we're putting it into the state law and authorizing the way it'll be handled. So the bill really has two provisions. It requires that the contractors that are doing this kind of renovation, again, for members who may not be familiar, childhood lead poisoning is really caused by lead dust that's released sometimes in construction, sometimes when there's a break in the roof and you have ceiling paint falling down. It's the dust that's in the old lead paint that is poisonous to children and causes permanent neurological damage. And we've been working on this issue for quite a few years in Minnesota, more than 20 years, and we've actually led the nation in some of the ways that we've done this, and we've worked very closely with our property owners and with the construction trades and so on. And so this law puts into our state law the authorization that the certification that's required by the EPA. And the tweaks that we did to it made it clear today that we're talking about the contractors need to be trained on how to prevent the childhood lead poisoning from happening by the way that they're working with the property. And it also makes clear that the exemptions that are in the federal law are also in the Minnesota law. We had some concern from some small contractors if they were working within within just a few, I think it's 6 square feet, that's exempted under the federal law. And we do the same thing here by making it clear that we're in accordance with the exact code of federal regulations. So there will be a way that the contractors who are doing this kind of work will get licensed. They'll be working in a lead-safe way, protecting themselves as workers, contractors and their workers, and also the families that have children living in those properties. I'm going to see if there's any. Do you want to provide a little testimony?
Sure.
Mr. Sam Walseth is here with me. He brought the legislation to us. We also have people from the Department of Health and others who would be willing to testify, but I think I'll ask Sam from the Sustainable Resources Center, who's, I want to give them credit. They're doing a lot of the work in Minnesota to help us clean up our properties and protect our children.
Mr. Walseth, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walsa. I lobby on behalf of the Sustainable Resources Center. SRC is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to healthy housing, specifically cleaning up old lead paint hazards in residential properties. They've been doing work for a couple decades, and through a lot of support from the state and leveraging federal dollars, that we've been able to clean up a lot of houses around Minnesota. Minnesota, as Representative Clark said, is a nation leader in dealing with the childhood lead poisoning problem. Specifically to this bill, the federal government is implementing a new Environmental Protection Agency rule. I think it goes into effect on April 22nd of this year, that will require contractors doing work on pre-78 properties, targeted housing as they call it, or child-occupied facilities, that they have to go through essentially a one-day training course, get their certification, and then that's valid for 5 years. That requirement is going into effect. What we're trying to do with this legislation is highlight the new rule and provide some accountability to make sure that it's actually being enforced. And so what we're trying to do is make a simple notification on the contractor license to state that they have actually met the certification, provide the form, and then on the license essentially have a checkbox that says we have met this and it's valid until such and such a date. That's what we're really looking for. If you look at your driver's license on the back, it'll say, you know, I need corrective lenses to be able to drive. That's essentially what we're looking for on the contractor license, is just a notification that they are in compliance with the new federal rule.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for the author or the testifier? Seeing none. On this bill, I also have on the list of Mr. Dan, is it Loescher?
The Department of Health is here, I think, to answer questions about if there are questions. But
Lasher, my apologies. And Mr. Joachim, do you wish to testify? Nope, that was a good wave off. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 3293 as amended? Perfect. Is right. All right. With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 3293, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Clark, cookies and milk.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Mahoney, I believe we're up to you, sir. The chair will move House File 2945 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Mr. Chair, if I will excuse me, I left something to pass out.
All right.
Travis? Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Mahoney.
House File 2945 essentially comes because of a court decision. I think it was in 2007 that negated all maintenance and rental codes in the state with a simple statement that says the state building code is supreme and nothing can be different than the state building code. What this bill does, 2945, on line 1.19, changes the word different from and inserts in conflict with, and on 2.32 inserts property maintenance and rental codes. Members, what we have here is a state building code that is designed for new buildings. But in every city, every town, whether it's 500 people or 500,000 people, has homes or most of them, have homes that are pre-state building code. So there is confusion. With this lawsuit, most all of the inspectors I have talked to said they are unclear if they can enforce the code in pre-72 buildings. Their other problem is that without a maintenance code, they can't go in and say, you know, our city wants linoleum on the floor. The state building code only requires plywood. Landlord could say, that's plywood, that's 5/8 plywood, that's just fine. We like plywood in our homes, and we're not going to put anything different down. And the inspectors couldn't do anything. Chimneys falling down. When you have combustion, you create a gas, you create water, eats away at the concrete, and after a good number of years, chimney needs to be tuck pointed. Without a maintenance or rental code, you would not have the ability to say fix that unless they were pulling a permit for a new furnace or new water heater. And even if it did fall down, or even if they were pulling a permit, so if they chose to put in a direct vent heating or water heater, they could avoid that because you're not dealing with the chimney directly. The cities are now left at this particular point without any way to enforce a standard of maintenance on their homes. So what this bill does is allow them to have that. I could go on and on about this in many different ways, but the real just, the concern that people have brought forth and used as an argument is the wording that says on page 1, line 19, in conflict with. And here's where the rub comes for cities and inspectors. The definition of different from versus in conflict with. As I said earlier, the linoleum. You could have the state building code does not require painting of a house on the exterior. So a city could not tell you you have to paint your house if you have never painted it, or the paint is peeling to a point where it's problematic. And the funny thing is that back in 2001, the people who are opposing this particular bill put into law, they changed 16B.62, which is now 326B.121, where I'm trying to change. They actually put the words in different from, and then on, as you'll see on this bill, on line 2.33, unless the ordinance conflicts. So I'm not entirely sure why they have now decided that conflict and different are such a big deal. We're trying to allow the cities to say that you need to maintain your properties, upgrade your properties when it's appropriate, and try to not get into more lawsuits. And I can stand for questions. I have multiple people here to testify. I have the support of most major cities. The well, I better read these people's names off, otherwise I'll get in trouble. I have the support of building officials. I have I have all the people who are opposed it in here. I didn't put down the names of the ones that are supporting it.
Representative Mahoney,
yeah.
Pages have passed out something from the Minnesota Association of Housing Code Officials and the Association of Minnesota Building Officials.
That would be one, yes.
Okay. I thought maybe those were different people, but...
No. And then, members, they've hopefully passed out this.
And they have.
And that tells you the number of rental units per county, and on the second page, the cities, the larger cities. So it's an issue. It's a huge issue for the Twin City metro area with 300,000 rental units, but it spreads far and wide. Fargo-Moorhead is 33,000. Rochester is 14,000. St. Cloud's 18,000. go to some of the counties, St. Louis County with 21,000 rental units. Right now, there's no rental or maintenance code for these particular cities.
And Representative Mahoney, am I noting that on the bottom of page 2 that this is 2007 data? Page 2 of the renter-occupied housing units. Because I know in my city with the foreclosure crisis, we're seeing significant numbers of homes that have been foreclosed being bought for the purpose of, bought by speculators for the purpose of rental conversion. And there's growing concern that while many of those folks will be excellent landlords, some of them are looking to come in, sit on a property, rent it briefly with as little investment as possible, and then roll it over with a sale.
And Mr. Chair, you're correct. Without a rental code, without a maintenance code, unless it is part of the building component, as defined by the Supreme Court, and they use the Webster Dictionary, so they've got every building official confused in the state at this particular point. If there was, the copper was stolen out, they would have problems telling the owner to actually go in and repair that. If there were painting issues or there was torn carpet, they could not go in and tell them to change or repair that. If the pipes had frozen and the floors had warped, they would not be able to go in and tell them to repair that because it does not address, the state building code does not address repair. So, again, I have cities, I have the city's lawyers here, I have the department is here. So I can stand for questions or we could hear the testimony of the opponents.
What's your preference, Representative Mahoney?
We may as well bring down the people who don't like me today.
All right. Very good. We've got four or five people on the list. If testifiers could, as always, remain brief and focused in an attempt not to be redundant on past testifiers, I think the committee would appreciate that. The first person on my list is Ms. Berger. Ms. Berger, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Christine Berger, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Mm-hmm. We respectfully oppose House File 2945 today. We believe this bill creates a large exemption to the state building code in a way that is contrary to the code itself and creates confusion in an area that's supposed to help bring uniformity and clarity and consistency across the state. So whether you're practicing in Albert Lea or Alexandria, you know what the state building code is and what those standards are. This would create a new patchwork of codes all over the state by municipalities. We also find that it will cause significant costs to homeowners in that if you're trying to sell your property particularly and if the municipality has a point of sale ordinance and you'd be required to, if they require you to update your property to these new higher standards that exceed the state building code, there'd be additional costs on the property owner. And as we all know right now, the real estate market is not doing so well. A lot of people are selling their property to avoid foreclosure. They don't have a lot of money to make expensive upgrades to their property. We feel that the code should remain uniform across the state. And it should have common predictable standards. And I will let my other advocates explain further. Thank you very much.
Ms. Berger, if I recall correctly, a few years ago, Representative Dill had a bill about whether you had to put your gun in a case when you were transporting it. And as I recall, the argument was if I was going on a hunting trip from my home in Minneapolis, driving up to wherever, the problem was, to Representative Solberg's district, the problem was one municipality would have one rule and another municipality would have another. And if I got pulled over for speeding, the police officer in that municipality would be enforcing their local code and I could be on gun transportation, and I could be in compliance 5 miles north of where I was or 5 miles south of where I was, but not in compliance with where I was. And while I probably voted against Representative Dill, I could understand the logic. My experience is houses don't move that fast. And that isn't it a reasonable expectation that if I own a home that I understand the rules and regulations in that community? I'm making a commitment there. If it's rental property, I'm operating a business there. Isn't understanding that Bloomington has, where I'm doing my business is different than Andover where I'm doing my business because it's rooted there? Ms. Berger?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. We would argue that if you're working in Bloomington as a realtor and then you have to go work in Andover, because that happens, realtors work all over various geographic regions, it would be great, as it is under current law, one set standard, one code, so that no matter where you're working, you have this one uniform standard.
Thank you. Next on the list is Mr. Lundquist. Am I saying that right, sir?
Close enough.
All right, thank you. Please state your name and pronounce it correctly for the record and proceed with your
thank
testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Todd Lundquist, I represent Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. And actually, start with the answer to your question. You didn't ask me the question, but I will start at that spot, actually. The legislature has stated for 30 years, and in fact the last couple years, has restated that a uniform statewide building code is the policy that we're going to enforce statewide. And for a number of reasons, that makes the most sense. When they go through the building code process, when they go through the adoption process, there is a burden that people who would like items to be included or excluded have to show. And they have to show that there's a statement of need and reasonableness for a particular item to be in there. Expert testimony is provided as to what makes the most sense for the uniform nature of our housing stock in the state. And that is a policy decision that the legislature has consistently reiterated. So that, from my standpoint, is the answer to a question that was not asked to me. We also respectfully oppose House by law 2945. We believe that this bill undermines the uniformity of the statewide building code. It provides in law authority for cities to exceed the building code. Let me give you a couple examples. A property in compliance with the state building code and the code under which that property was built is silent on a particular item. The in conflict with language would allow a city to require a property to be equipped with that, which is exceeding the building code. That's currently not required under that particular building code under which it was built. For example, ground fault interrupters, a property built under a code that did not require ground fault interrupters. The in conflict with language would allow a city to come in and say, all right, all of our properties are going to have to be equipped with ground fault interrupters. The code under which your property was built was silent on it. That's not in conflict with the code that it was built under. It's different from, but it's not in conflict with. Second example, where a minimum is required in the statewide building code, a city could require you to exceed that minimum. Egress windows. A property built prior to 1983 is required to be equipped with egress windows, which is a retrofit item. Egress windows with a square footage of 5.0 square feet, at least 5.0 square feet. The property owner could willingly go beyond that for safety reasons. The in conflict with language would allow a city to come in and say, all right, all of our egress windows have to be 6 feet, 6.0 square feet. That's different from the requirement, but it's not in conflict with. The property owner would still be in compliance with the statewide building code, either at 5.0 or 6.0, because the property owner can exceed it by choice. But what this would allow would be a city to come in and say, you're going to have 6.0 square feet windows. The Supreme Court actually did address the in conflict with language. What they did say is when they were analyzing the language of the statewide building code, they said different from doesn't take a lot of analysis. We know what different from means. One thing we do know is different from is not the same as in conflict with. And when they talked about in conflict with, they said that no conflict exists when an ordinance is merely additional and complementary to a state law. That's the concern that we have. additional. If something is additional, according to the Supreme Court, in this very opinion, it's not in conflict with. The other thing that makes us nervous is that the proponents in private conversations and in public forums, the examples that they've used would allow retrofitting. What they would like to do is exceed the building code. Last year, we were among a group that actually offered language saying, clarifying, even though we think it's unnecessary, clarifying that a city still has the authority to require property maintenance, so long as they do not require that property to exceed the statewide building code. And that language was denied and was rejected out of hand, which, in our opinion, that shows that the cities truly do want to exceed the statewide building code. One other example is we dealt with this, our association dealt with this back in the early to mid-90s, is RPZ valves. They're backflow prevention valves on boilers. And the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul were saying that all properties, all rental properties of two units or more, and all businesses had to be equipped with those. Well, they're expensive items, and some people say that they're unnecessary, and other valves provide the same types of protection. But most importantly, they exceed the statewide building code as a retrofit item. They're not required as a retrofit item, but the cities were adamant. Extensive time, extensive discussion, months went by, and some of our property owners actually complied, and they were told by the city to retrofit, and they did. They spent significant amounts of money retrofitting unnecessarily, and ultimately they backed off when we were able to convince them that the building code does not require that. So that's one example. What this would allow is to put in law that they can require such things. I've already talked about the uniformity of the statewide building code, and the legislature has consistently reiterated that. This bill is not needed. The two things that they say is that they cannot require properties to be maintained, and that's simply not true. The Supreme Court, in this opinion, specifically stated in the language that should be in your packets, that cities still have ample authority to deal with property maintenance. And keep in mind, this only relates to building code provisions. So painting, grass cutting, junk cars, broken windows, those sorts of things, those aren't building code provisions, and they would not be prevented from dealing with those under current law. As to the chimney example, if something is broken and needs to be repaired, cities absolutely can go in and require a property owner, property manager to fix that. As to unsafe conditions, there's a current process, the building code process, which has many steps along the way. There are safeguards and protections in place, and if someone wants a retrofit item to be required for safety reasons, they can go and petition and go to the group that adopts it and state their case and show that there's a statement of need and reasonableness. And there are retrofit items, smoke detectors, CO detectors, egress windows, and those sorts of things. This law would not have those same safeguards at the city level. Finally, one comment about the provision on the second page, 2.32, as to that additional language. That section does use conflicts with language, but it's entirely reasonable to use conflicts with language. What that section is talking about is zoning, subdivision, and planning. Subdivision 2C on the first page, where it has the different from language, that's where it's talking about city building code as compared to the state building code. 2G is talking about zoning, planning, and subdivision. You can't say, it doesn't make any sense to say a city building code has to be the same as, I'm sorry, a city zoning code has to be the same as the state building code. Well, they regulate two entirely different things. It makes no sense at all. Finally, as I said, the city of Morris B. Sacks changed nothing, and the current state of the law is the same as it was before. The Supreme Court just interpreted the law as it was intended to be written and intended to be read by the legislature, and has consistently been stated as such. This is new language. It's never been tested in conflict with. Never been tested. If we're looking for clarity, why do we go to a new standard that has never been tested in the building code context? We ask that you keep the statewide building code uniform and vote against House Bill 2945.
Thank you, sir. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I had, and I'm going to ask similar questions of proponents too, but I see this language that you handed out from the Supreme Court case, this footnote 7 that's underlined here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting, and I think it arguably cuts both ways. It says here that our decision should not be misconstrued as precluding all municipal regulation of rental housing. And then it goes down to say rental housing regulations are not prohibited by the state building code, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says, right, if they do not regulate components or systems of a residential structure. So are we really talking about, and forget, this will show my ignorance of the state building code and those issues, but so are we really talking about whether or not, if what you're saying is that the case didn't really change law, are we really just talking about what relates to components or systems of a residential structure, and that if it falls on one side of the line or the other, is that your argument? That so, for example, if a city wanted to, say, impose a requirement about railings in a certain context, isn't it a matter of interpretation whether that that ordinance would be would pertain to components or systems of a residential structure? Some might say it is, some might say it isn't. Is that really what we're talking about here? I mean, I'm asking genuinely. I'm not an expert on these issues.
It's Mr. Rogenquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon. Essentially, so what the Supreme Court said was that three issues. If the provision, if the issue being regulated is a building code provision, if it regulates components or systems, it can't be different from. So yes, that is one of the issues that one of the items that is at issue here, and it's our belief that cities have been requiring things for a number of years that did not comply with this, and essentially, it's very costly, very time consuming. And it's a very big risk for someone to challenge a city when they're requiring certain things that they believe they should not be requiring. And finally, it took someone to actually challenge. So
just a quick thought.
Representative Simon.
So using that hypothetical, I'll put you on the spot. I'll ask the same kind of question to the other folks. So given that example, say a railing requirement, and maybe you need more context, and maybe I just don't know enough to phrase the question as narrowly as it should be, but say a railing requirement, and I don't even know where. Let's say on the front steps to an apartment building or something, you have to have a railing. Do you have an idea here about which side of the line that would fall on? Do you think a railing requirement is something that regulates components or systems of a residential structure, or not really, or?
Mr. Rosenquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I do believe that the statewide building code does regulate railings. So it is a building code provision, and I do believe that it regulates a component or system. If it's a railing on the staircase or something, the staircase is absolutely a component or system, an essential part of that structure. So yes, I do believe it would.
And just
well, Simon.
Follow up, and again, I'm sure showing my ignorance of these kinds of issues. What if, let's say, the city's concern was people not falling? And so they decide, well, we don't want to do railing because that might be different from or under the post-Morris v. Sachs world. Let's say they say we can't do that, but let's try some sort of ordinance that says that in the winter you have to salt or shovel in front of those steps periodically. I don't know what it is, once a day, twice a day, something like that.
Yep.
Would that be okay or would that not be okay, in your opinion, under the post-Sachs v. Morris world?
Mr. Rosenquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that would be, my opinion, that's entirely reasonable, entirely allowable under the post-Morris v. Sachs scenario. That's part of property maintenance. And the sidewalk or the area out front that is not, in my opinion, a building code provision and is not necessarily a component or system, which falls in the area of property maintenance. I don't think any interpretation of the Morris v. Sachs case would say that a city could not require salt to be laid down, or shoveling to be done, or grass to be cut, or anything along those lines.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, that's exactly it. Salting of a sidewalk, cutting grass, that's not in the state building code, not in its entirety. It probably wouldn't take even a second-year law student to go into court and have any, it would be different than in conflict and not in the state building code. Any judge would be probably not doing their job if they didn't throw that particular requirement out. Now, there are issues here. And would I like to have a statewide maintenance code? Absolutely. I would love to have one. But one of the problems is that the time frames of putting code into law, or adopting that code, we're not scheduled till the year 2013, maybe 2014, to have another code cycle adopted. And with our current budgetary cycle problems, I should say, it could easily slip 3 years beyond that. There are codes out there that are international, that are residential property maintenance codes. I think they're great ideas. With some amendments for the state of Minnesota, they work fine. Maybe they could address salting and sanding sidewalks. Who knows? But we're not going to have those without any question, with any question whatsoever, for at least 3 more years, and it could easily stretch out another 6 years. I'm going to address a couple of things in the egress windows. When it's in conflict with, if the state fire marshal says that they have to be 5 square feet, I think it is, the city could not come in and say, no, make them five and a half square feet. That would be in conflict with then a state building code. And the GFIs, when you are in business, when you are in making a profit off the public, there are certain higher standards you should meet. Safety standards, GFIs in a bathroom, GFIs in a kitchen. I think the RPZ valve is important, but obviously there's some questions on that, because the RPZ, just so you understand, is what breaks the, doesn't allow water to backflow from a toilet or a boiler or wherever into the main water system of the city or your well. And I thought it was a bad decision back then, but I'm not going back to that one. So in answer to your question, and that's where the problem is, and that's what this law, this bill will do, is clarify that and allow the cities to have that authority to say, fix the railing, mow the grass, put the salt and sand down, or whatever.
Representative Simon.
Okay, a couple follow-ups. Representative Mahoney, so when you say it'll give them the power to say, fix the railing, will it give them the power just to say, install the railing?
Representative Mahoney.
I believe, because I don't have the state building code in front of me, and I'm relatively sure that all buildings have to have a railing on the stairs. So that is already there. It would give them the power to go in and say, your balusters, that, you know, the posts that hold up the railing, are too far apart, so children can get caught in them, like happened a number of years ago, and get injured. But they could not go in and just say, I don't think they would have to, because all stairs have to have railings on them now in the state building code.
Representative Simon.
Okay, just in the interest of fairness then, on reading back the same Supreme Court decision here, footnote 7, which is in our handouts here, the underlying language says, our decision should not be misconstrued as precluding all municipal regulation of rental housing, and then beneath there, underlined, it says, in addition, municipal rental housing regulations are not prohibited by the state building code if they do not regulate components or systems of a residential structure covered by the state building code, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, this doesn't give you enough comfort, but is the reason it doesn't give you enough comfort because this only talks about rental housing and you believe it's not speaking to other housing, or is there some other reason why when you look at this footnote 7, you still see the need for the bill? That obviously that wasn't good enough. So you see the need for the bill despite footnote 7. Why? Is it because this only speaks to rental housing or some other reason?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon. It's not so much that piece that doesn't give me comfort, but what it says here is it can't be different than the state building code. And that's the problem. You can have a rental code that is the state building code, but it still doesn't cover repairs. So you can't go in and say, under the state building code, I'm asking you to repair. I can go underneath the state building code and say, I want you to build to these standards. But I can't go in and say, repair to these standards. And that's, so it's kind of, they didn't even need to put that in, because it doesn't do any good. Because different than in state law negates that. You unfortunately had 7 lawyers trying to figure out what typically confuses building officials on that do it for a living. And they went to the Webster Dictionary to define components, and we're still trying to figure out what the heck that means.
Representative Mahoney, I'm on a different part of the same page than Representative Simon. You're done, Representative Simon is on, and I'm wondering if this is the concern. Under Part 4, I've underlined a sentence about halfway in where it says, we recognize that substandard housing raises health and safety issues for municipalities, and the disposition of this case raises considerations about the ability of municipalities to address these issues. Is that, I'm on the bottom paragraph on the first column.
No.
Yeah. I underlined it on my copy, but it's not underlined on anybody else's. Is the concern that with the changes under Morris v. Sachs, the Supreme Court is saying here it could yield more substandard housing, which is not only raises health and safety issues for the occupants of that housing, but detrimentally impacts the housing values of everyone in the area as well, whether it's rental or owner-occupied? Is that part of the concern here, Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
I like the one-word answers. Ms. Frenette. I assume you're not there for the view.
Well, it is nice to be here. I'm actually here to collect on frequent flyer miles. I haven't been here yet this year. I spent a lot of time in this committee last year.
You did, but have you transferred them over to the new airline?
Transferred them over to the new airline.
All right, very good.
I wanted to make sure that I continued to collect them, and I missed the committee.
And the committee misses you, Ms. Frenette.
There's the cookies. Christine always has good cookies. Lisa Frenette, I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. Thank you very much for your time. I'll be brief because Todd and Christine have said a lot of what we already feel. Something that we did a couple years ago here at the state legislature that was overwhelmingly passed was the statewide building code, to make sure that we had a consistent playing field for everything that was happening in terms of building and remodeling, and that the codes were the same throughout the state. We're always concerned that, and our biggest concern within conflict with is that all of a sudden we have codes that go outside of the statewide building code. We update the statewide building code every 3 years. Because I'm kind of moving my testimony around and being brief because most of the questions have been answered or discussed. First of all, Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, railings are regulated by the codes. Currently, they absolutely are, so you've got that. Our concern, again, is where you might get something that would go above or outside and suddenly, like a window egress covering is not in the code. We realize it's not addressed. We believe that if people feel that there's window egress covering should be covered, that they should come through the code process. Something that the Builders Association of Minnesota would like to see is the implementation of something called the International Property Maintenance Code. And the International Property Maintenance Code addresses things like mowing the lawns, plumbing, different plumbing, heating, different things that should be done for the health and safety of people. Representative Simon, it would address salting sidewalks, et cetera, things like that. Representative Mahoney had addressed earlier that a water heating system would not have to be updated or a new one would have to be put in if something like the International Property Maintenance Code was installed statewide. It does address water heaters. So we believe that a great idea would be to put in the property maintenance code. We have heard from Representative Mahoney that it would take 18 months to address a property maintenance code because that's how long it takes for the International Residential Code. This is actually how you need to build a house. This is 329 pages. This is 32 pages. We believe that something could be done in a short amount of time. Builders like it because then it leaves a bright line, like for builders and remodelers, as to what property maintenance codes are and what actual codes are. Like to address Representative Mahoney's comment, we are the association that pushed for conflicts with in G. Again, the difference is zoning, where you flip it over and you've got different from city codes and state building codes. And then real quickly, there has been a lot of discussion through the Property Maintenance Task Force, and building officials have been involved with the discussions on this. And my clear idea and understanding is the building officials throughout the state aren't in agreement as to whether or not the language in the statute needs to be changed. We have inner ring suburb cities that don't feel the statute needs to be changed, and we have rural areas that have no problems with rental maintenance codes and feel that if this changed, it could actually make a problem for them, heard back from them, because they're not here to defend themselves. I'm not going to say who they are, but we have heard that. And then I think, again, I kind of went quickly because all the questions were answered. So if I went in different order, let me know and ask. I'm open for questions.
It does seem that we've spent a fair amount of time exploring the issue so far.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Frenette. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Sanders. For Mahoney. Oh, yeah, those will come later. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I have not heard from any building officials other than the letter that was handed out, and I'm pretty available. I would like to call down the City of Minneapolis's inspector to give some clarity and give their perspective on this, and the Assistant Commissioner Joachim to talk about the timeline of adopting the International Property Maintenance Code and how long and the difficulties. Hopefully they'll be very brief.
Thank you. Mr. Joachim, you're next on the list, and it seems to flow off of Ms. Frenette's testimony. So if you would come forward and welcome back, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. I think you've heard the differing views of different and in conflict with, and that's the issue that I agree with both sides. There are pluses to this.
And job security, isn't it?
and our concern is we get the questions from the local code officials, and Mr. Sachs on the Moore Sachs case called me specifically and asked me questions. Can they do this? And so. So we responded to that and said, no, you cannot have a local ordinance that is more restrictive than a state building code. Now, whether you call it in conflict with or different than, I don't know which is the better term. We would like to see something that clarifies what the intent is. So that would help us so that we could iron this out. The code adoption process that Representative Mahoney is talking about, our normal code adoption process through the APA process that the legislature has laid out for us takes approximately at least a year, if not a year and a half, to do that. And then the Builders Association passed legislation that helps us and the industry by adding another 6 months to that time frame so that we can get the books published and we can get training and education out before the code goes into effect. So everybody has training and education, and when we do amendments to the documents, that those Minnesota amendments can be published with the rest of the document to do that. We already have in the state fire code the 2003 International Property Maintenance Code that Ms. Frenette was showing is an appendix chapter that cities can adopt. However, there is automatically provisions in that based on the Morris Sachs case that are in conflict with or different than the state building code, probably more than two or three, but at least two or three that I'm aware of that are in that document. So is this an issue with us? Yes, we have a concern. We would like to see this defined better so that we would all know that here's where it applies and here's where it doesn't apply. The state building code has always been a new construction document. The state fire code has generally been a maintenance document But before we had the state building code as a statewide standard, when the state fire marshal would want to make inspections in the non-building code administered area, he or she had to use the state fire code, and if the fire code didn't reference any of those sections, how did they get back to making sure those buildings met certain standards? So they incorporated a lot of state building code stuff into the state fire code, which confuses the issue now. Now that the state building code is a statewide standard, we think the next code adoption cycle that we can address the state building code as new construction. We have the model document that we adopt also establishes an international existing building code that for remodeling existing buildings. We can use the fire code, a portion of it for maintenance of commercial buildings, and then we could adopt this international property maintenance code and amend it as a consensus group to address maintenance of existing buildings. So we think this could happen the next code cycle, but right now this is a confusing issue, as you've heard the testimony, that I think you could take a poll probably on the committee and is different than or in conflict with who agrees with one or the other, and that's the issue right now that is causing the stir amongst the cities and the builders and the multi-housing association.
I'm not going to testify. I'm going to be him forever now.
Representative Sanders, your question is for Representative Mahoney, so we can hold until we're done with testifiers. Is that Representative Solberg, yours is to Mr. Joachim?
No, yeah, Mr. Joachim, is there anything in the law right now or in this proposed change in the law that would allow your agency or to go forward with the process of adopting a statewide maintenance code?
Mr. Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the language in G would say that, because that allows the cities to adopt a property maintenance code. We already believe we have authority to establish one in the state building code, but that would clarify for sure that municipalities can adopt one. At least that would, in our minds, that would help for sure. The language change, again, I think there's six of one half.
Representative Solberg,
help clarify that you could do it, that the state could do a statewide maintenance code?
Mr. Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe we already have authority to do one, but this would just confirm that the municipalities could adopt one.
But Mr. Representative Solberg, I think maybe is if you could explain the timeline, I think, is the problem, because you can't adopt one tomorrow.
Right.
Well, I understand that.
Representative Solberg.
My next question is, other than 3 years from now, is there a will or a thought from your agencies to start that process of adopting a statewide maintenance code?
And Mr. Director, let me add to Representative Solberg's question for me. Is that a free process?
Yeah. That's my next question.
Oh, okay. Get you to it.
Chair,
all right.
Representative, one, it is a free process. It's a wide open process. We develop ad hoc advisory committees, pull in all the industries that we can think of to comment and address issues, take recommendations. My Commissioner Swiggum makes the final decision on the what we present in the document. It goes through the rule process. Everybody, all the industries can challenge the rule. They can require a hearing if they would like, testify before the judge, and then the rules get adopted and they're put in play. We think that is an open process. We think we have the ability to do that.
Is there a cost to the school?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is.
Thank you.
Do you have, Mr. Chair, any kind of idea what that cost is?
Mr. Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative, generally a small rulemaking process is around $50,000.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
If I might ask, would this be a small rulemaking change?
Mr. Joachim. It's not often the author's question is on witnesses, but we'll go with it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'm not sure if it would be a small one or a large rulemaking process, but it would definitely, we would have a lot of time, let's say, in the consensus committee.
The city of Minneapolis, I believe, wants to testify, and the chair had hoped to have a vote on this by 11:30. We're ponderous today, and that's not a value. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will
dispense with a lot of what I have to say since it has already been said, and I'll just answer questions if there are things that I left folks uncertain about. The main problem that we're facing in Minneapolis and in municipalities across the state is that the state building code is not a maintenance code, and that's the bottom line. Under the Morris versus Sachs decision, we are allowed to only enforce a state building code when we have any regulations dealing with components or systems of buildings. And the state building code allows us only to be reactive to situations once they've reached a point of critical problem or safety. They don't allow municipalities to engage in any proactive or preventative action. So my main point here is to give you some examples of things that we can't do under Morris versus Sachs that we've been doing for over 100 years in Minneapolis, since our housing maintenance code is over 100 years old. The things that we used to do before this court decision. The solution at hand really is intended to restore the balance of local authority over maintenance that existed prior to the court decision. The first example, Representative Mahoney already touched on, so I'll be very brief. Heating systems. Municipalities could reasonably desire a maintenance provision requiring rental property owners to have their heating systems inspected and tuned up on a periodic basis, annually, biannually, whatnot. This becomes important because of the foreclosure crisis across the state. In Minneapolis, we are seeing a conversion rate of single-family homes from owner occupancy to rental twice the historic average, and that continues strong. When we are looking at single-family homes where rental property owners aren't paying the utilities, they lack the financial incentive to make sure that those heating systems are operating efficiently because the tenants are paying those heating bills. But it's more than just an energy saving or energy efficiency issue. We're talking about a safety issue because an inefficient or faulty heating system is a safety problem. And under the building code, the only time we can do something about a faulty heating system is after it's proven to be faulty, typically after somebody's been hurt or worse. So in order to get out in front of that, you need a maintenance provision to allow cities to do that. The issue of floor coverings. The building code requires plywood. In a kitchen where typically there's a vinyl covering or something more substantive, in a rental property, that vinyl wears a hole in it. A maintenance provision would allow us to require the replacement of that vinyl because it has a hole in it. And that's not just an aesthetic issue. When you have plywood subfloor exposed in a kitchen, you have something that can foster the development of bacteria and be a real health issue. And so the building code wouldn't allow us to issue orders on that because the building code's being complied with. The plywood is there. We would have to wait till the plywood rotted through before the building code allows us to do anything. We want to do something a little quicker to ensure safety. Now, paint was brought up as an example that we can continue to enforce, but that's not true. If you look at the rationale under the Morris versus Sachs decision, particularly the rationale that applied to the window egress window covers, we will not be able to require paint of a building because the siding, trim, and windows are building components. And we can't have any regulations outside of the building code when we're dealing with building components. We can't require that peeling paint on an exterior of a building be repaired. Now, that's not a safety issue. That could be a health issue if it's lead paint, but it's typically an aesthetic issue, that cities, I think, rightfully are concerned with maintaining authority over. Bathroom sinks. Just a couple more.
Maybe just one more.
Okay, one more.
You're on a roll. I want to stop that.
Bathroom sink. Give you door locks. The state building code does not require locks on the exterior of a door. Under a maintenance provision, we could require landlords to provide locks on those doors. There's another state law that requires locks on the exterior of multifamily apartment building type buildings. So that would apply, but not to a rental property owner of a single family home. If they chose not to provide locks to their tenants, there's nothing we could do about it.
So the one thing we need you to do is introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot your very first direction. I'm Henry Reimer. I'm the Director of Inspections in Minneapolis.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who feels compelled to testify either for or against? All right. Representative Sanders, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your patience, sir.
Absolutely.
Representative Mahoney, I believe it was last week that you defined the state building code, and I believe these are your words because I thought it was an excellent answer, but you defined the state building code as a minimum-maximum standard, and I believe that's what you said, unless you disagree with that. But to me, the phrase different from really seems to support that definition. And so it appears as if we are trying to now also make the state building code a state maintenance code. And I'm not quite sure if that is the best decision or not, the best vehicle. Perhaps you could just briefly address that, because I think your definition of last week with the different from does seem to really make sense, and in conflict with, you know, like you said, looks like we might be completely transforming the state building code.
Mr. Chair.
Even the members are asking for brevity. Representative Mahoney.
I don't believe that we're making the state building code into a maintenance code. What we're doing with this bill, in page 2, is allows the cities and the municipalities to create a rental or property maintenance code that is not in conflict with the state building code. As the state building code is a minimum maximum that addresses new construction. So maintenance and rental properties is not typically new construction. So what we're trying to do is give the cities and the municipalities the ability to create a maintenance code that fits their needs in their cities. And I will tell you, Ms. Frenette brought up the property maintenance code. But I don't believe our cities and our towns can wait 2 or 3 years without any kind of control over the maintenance of their buildings. And I'm very comfortable once the department puts that maintenance code into place, you know, making sure that is the standard. But as witness, they've had more than several meetings on trying to negotiate some kind of deal here, and they have not been able to. And I could say one side is being obstinate or the other. I don't care. When you can't come up with an idea, you can't come up with a solution, it ends up in our laps, and we have to figure out a way to keep our cities, you know, safe and properly maintained.
Right. Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'll just be brief. I have a couple of questions, but I'll just make a comment. Just from listening to the testimony, you know, I can understand the need for perhaps maintenance code and that, but, you know, there's other avenues for tenants to raise issues with landlords who are not properly maintaining properties or complaints about repairs that need to be done. But just listening to your testimony and Mr. Loganquist, I think was pronunciation of the name, about the egress window. You know, you both disagreed on whether or not that different from or in conflict with how that would be interpreted. And so it just seems to me that this is kind of another lawyer's full employment act here in sorting that out. And I just raise that as a concern.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Loon. Representative Mahoney, any closing statement?
Save my city.
Enough said. With that, the chair renews. Well, Mahoney, that's right. You're a member of the committee, aren't you?
I am.
Okay. Thank you for your service.
You moved it the first time, so I'll let you move it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Mahoney moves that House File 2945 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Solberg.
Representative Dabney, you want to make a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I thank you for this. I'd like to move House File 3170 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I would still hope this committee will be able to adjourn on time at noon so that we do not have to come back at 6 p.m. As the agenda indicates we have the room for.
Well, let's try to move this along fairly rapidly if we can, but allow everyone ample time to be able to testify. So for the testifiers, if it's been said once, maybe we don't have to say it four times, okay?
All right.
Okay, Representative Dabney, do you want to explain your bill?
Certainly. Representative Solberg, Mr. Chair, members, in 1995, I believe it was, because of concerns over the negative impacts of payday lending on Minnesotans, this legislature created the small loan statute for regulating those entities that provide payday loans. We did what we do here. We set the white lines on the road and allowed businesses then to play within those lines. In 1996, for reasons that nobody can quite explain, there was a small loophole driven through that regulatory structure. Nobody paid any attention to it until 2002. That tells me that loophole in 1996 was inadvertent, an error in oversight, was not an intentional act on anyone's part, because around here, if you do something intentionally, somebody exploits it pretty darn quickly. What that has allowed to happen is three payday lenders have, instead of operating under the regulatory structure and the public policy that this legislature has established, have instead taken those white lines, they've found an off-ramp, they've found a detour, and instead are operating as industrial loan and thrifts against the intent of this legislature. That loophole allows them, and there's information in members' packets, to charge Minnesotans significantly higher percentage interest rates as well as fees on these loans. To the tune that this takes about $6 million out of Minnesotans' pockets, away from their families, compared to the other 24 payday lenders around the state who are operating under the appropriate regulatory structure. With me today is Mr. Ron Elwood from the Legal Services Advocacy Project. They have just released a study on these loophole lenders, and I'll let him speak briefly to it.
Welcome to the committee. Can you identify yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I believe you all have been given copies of the report that we compiled. I think the only thing I'd like to add to what Representative Dabney has already provided in terms of explaining the bill, it's very simple. In 1995, as Representative Dabney said, the legislature created a box to put payday lending into. There seems to be no rational justification. So we put the mice in the box. There's no rational justification to the next, putting a hole in the box to let some of the mice out. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so there are 28 payday lenders licensed in Minnesota. Only three of them use the loophole. Unfortunately, it costs, by our calculation, and it's an estimate, but I think if you look at the report and the methodology, I think it's a very sound estimate. Costs, by our calculations, consumers $6 million in overcharges that they otherwise shouldn't have been paying. And these, remember, I would remind you, are the most financially vulnerable folks. These are people who need these kinds of loans, and therefore, by definition, are very financially vulnerable. So that $6 million should have been in those families' pockets all along, and we ought to be closing the loophole. My one other comment I would make is that there are 16 other industrial loan and thrift licensees in Minnesota. They are the likes of Morgan Stanley, City Financial, those types of entities. Not a single one of those entities make payday loans. Conversely, none of the three loophole lenders do any of the other kinds of businesses that the other industrial loans and thrifts do. Therefore, I think there's only one conclusion to reach. This was an unintended loophole, and I would urge you to close it. Okay. Stand for questions.
Questions to the visit or to the testifier. Okay, we've had notice that another person would like to testify, Pastor Peters. Welcome to the committee, and if you can identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Representative Solberg and members of the committee. I've met with many of you, so I'm not going to repeat myself or try to keep it very brief here. I represent, my name is Pastor Mark Peters. I represent the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. And we have a policy council that is from all over Minnesota, representing the six bishops and six synods statewide. This is a top-tier issue for us. It's been identified as one of those areas that we unequivocally agree. And so I'm here before you today to speak to what I consider one of the most unsavory issues I've dealt with in my 15 years working as Executive Director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy. Christian tradition has talked about usury in the non-technical sense as charging outrageous and unconscionably high interest rates, and Martin Luther's writings speak extensively of this practice. Also, the bipartisan legislative commission to end poverty, speaking and addressing payday loans in this context, and after listening statewide to the struggles of the very vulnerable people that Ron referred to that are in need of this line of cash, said that calls for consumers must be able to rely on a fair financial marketplace. And I would posit here that there is nothing fair about this loophole. Closing this loophole is reasonable, it is responsible, and it is just. This would simply level the playing field, have everyone playing by the same rules. I've got 5 and 9-year-old boys, and they know what the rules are, and they stick by them. This is really clear in this instance here. Without the rules, how is it fair? How is it? The claim by the loophole lenders that they need this unconscionably high, usurious, greedy rate to stay in business or serve the public or meet demand is hogwash. It's like surreal. That's all I have to say.
Pastor Peters, I raised some boys and they never played by the rules.
Oh.
Until I enforced them.
That's right. That's right. That's very true.
Okay. Any questions of the witness? Thank you, Pastor Peters.
Thank you.
Is there anybody who would like to testify for the anybody else for Remy Stoll? Okay. Anybody for the? Okay. Then anybody against? Is it Remy? Is that correct? Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape, Paul and Remy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Casty with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard here on behalf of Payday America. Mr. Chairman, you're right. I will keep this brief. We've been here before. I think you've heard this testimony. In fact, I think I can set my watch to the first Friday of March every year. I think I've sat here and done the same thing. So
a
I think
rite
some
of spring.
Of you, it's a rite of spring, exactly. So I'll put that on my calendar for next year. But you're right. It's deja vu all over again. But one thing I want to remind everybody is that last year we were here and we did accomplish something. We passed a very, very comprehensive piece of legislation that I think was bipartisan, and I think the consumer groups and the industry worked together to get this done. I do want to remind you that probably 90% of that bill was passed last year, went into effect on August 1st, and hasn't really had time even to work yet. Second, this is obviously a solution looking for a problem. There are no complaints at the Attorney General's office. There are no complaints with the Commerce Department. The ones that do exist are with businesses that operate scrupulously on the Internet, where customers get fleeced, and there's no regulation of those transactions whatsoever. We have the toughest law in the country. We had the toughest law in the country before last year's law was passed. We continue to have it. We have an even tougher law as of today. The consumers in Minnesota are well protected. If this law wasn't in place and our business was forced to go out of business, people would be driven across the borders. They'd be driven to the Internet, where we can't touch the people that hurt them. Finally, I'd like to say that we do distinguish ourselves from the payday lenders and the payday statute. We operate under the Industrial Loan and Thrift Statute in Chapter 53, and we do that for a very good reason. We've made a business decision to offer our customers a flexibility and choice in the products that they can access when they're needed. These products obviously are very needed. We've done lots of transactions, as you can see by Mr. Elwood's background papers, and we will continue to. And we'll continue to take care of our customers who play by the rules, and we play by other rules as well. Mr. Chairman, I will stand for questions. Otherwise, I'll let Ms. Stone fill in the blanks here. And we also have a customer here who would like to, a few moments to testify as well. Thank you.
We'll take all the testimony. Ms. Stone, welcome. Do you want to give your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Remy Stone. I work for a company called Advance America, the nation's largest payday lender. I'm here on behalf of our National Trade Association, the Consumer Financial Services Association, just to register our continued opposition to any legislation that removes consumer choice in regard to credit, in particular when times are so difficult for families to make ends meet. We absolutely support the reforms that improve consumer lending, but in interest of brevity, I just want it to be absolutely clear that we do not support any legislation that harms consumers' choice.
Okay. Are there questions to the witness? Any questions to the witness? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for either Ms. Stone or Mr. Cassidy or anyone who would like to answer this, could you describe for me the disclosures that are included when someone would
corporate attorney do it.
Okay. Whoever you'd like to respond to that. But just the disclosure given to consumers who might be seeking one of these loans.
Hi, welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Todd Phelps. I'm a business attorney at Leonard Street and Dynard, and I'm for lack of a better term, the outside general counsel for Rixman Companies.
Did you understand the question? Do you want it repeated?
I did, Mr. Okay. Chairman, Representative
Loon.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Yes, the disclosures that we make to, in fact, the document that's used is the consumer open-ended note disclosure and credit agreement, and the disclosures that we make within that are dictated to us under federal law, the Truth in Lending Act, Regulation Z, which I'm sure many of you have seen if you've financed a car or a similar type of a credit arrangement. Those disclosures were enhanced in last year's legislation. Additional disclosures were made. We increased the font size, I think, to some ridiculous amount, so that of maybe 48 points or 24. I mean, so I don't think what the proponents of this bill have argued in the past, and I don't think they're arguing it this year, is that our customers or the customers don't understand what they're doing. What I think they're saying is they don't like this industry, they don't like these products being offered to these customers, and they don't think our customers, frankly, should have the ability to choose to make these types of loans.
Okay, just to follow up.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as you described, and I know some of those requirements on consumer disclosures can be very specific. One of the terms in there is least sophisticated consumer standard, and so is it your opinion, or is it indeed a fact that those disclosures would comply with that standard of being such that the lesser sophisticated consumers are able to understand the wording of those disclosures?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon, absolutely. I mean, as an attorney, I take a very conservative position on this because of the risk of liability, and in fact the enhanced remedies that were added to this statute from last year and the penalties that we could face if these disclosures differed in any way, shape, or form from the disclosures that we're required to make, again, under the Federal Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Phelps, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there someone else in the audience that would like to testify against the bill? Welcome to the committee, and if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, to the
Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Stan Green. I'm just simply a consumer. And I'll be brief. I've been up all night, and I came here because I wanted to say that I've been a customer of Payday America off and on for a few years, and I never felt vulnerable. I just like the idea of the choice, and they never made a loan to me that I wasn't able to repay, or that it would have been a struggle to repay. So I just want to say that, you know, it's been a good for me. It's nice to have that option. Like someone earlier said, in times like these, if things are real tight, and there comes a time, sometime when you need a loan, you know, you need some right away. And so it's a nice option for me, and it's short term. And so I don't feel like I'm predatored against or vulnerable customer or nothing. So, and I think on both sides, I don't make a loan that I can't pay, and I don't feel that they would lend me a loan that I couldn't repay back. So that's my say on that.
Mr. Green, we appreciate your testimony. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming all the way to do that. Is there anybody else that would like to testify for or against the bill? Any questions of the author? If not, we're ready to vote. Representative Dabney, do you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File 3170 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Okay. Have you heard the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And carried.
Thank you very much,
members,
thank
you. Mr. Murdoch, we'll get you out of here by noon.
Does the committee have my amendment to this? And Anita, is the amendment you did?
Representative Murdoch, I apologize, sir, and I appreciate your patience. We just got to figure a batting order here at the front. Thank you, sir.
Thank you
Representative Murdoch, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move that House File 3024 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Yes, I would.
All right. And Representative Murdoch, you have a delete all amendment, the A102246 amendment. Would you like to move that to be before the committee?
Yes, I would.
All right. And Representative Murdoch, I understand that you have an oral amendment on page 1, line 17, striking the word, striking after the comma, or listing agent. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Doesn't that period just slide over?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I believe that he can just, Representative Murdoch can just incorporate that into as an amendment? That's a yes.
Okay.
Oh, so the incorporation is delete the comma after retailer and strike or listing agent. That is your motion, Representative Murdoch?
Correct.
Thank you. And then members should have in their possession, I hope, Chair's amendment to the amendment, the H3024A1 amendment will be passed out now. If I may, Mr. Murdoch, Representative Murdoch, this enhances the consumer protections in your bill by assuring that the notice to the consumer is in a slightly larger font size and is printed on a separate sheet of paper, which is a different color than the purchase agreement, to highlight to the consumer some of the implications of the choices they're making, better consumer notice. Is this acceptable to you, Representative Murdoch?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, the chair will move the H3024A1 amendment to the amendment. Don't we do the amendment to the amendment and then do the amendment?
That would be what I think
you do. Mm-hmm. All right. Any discussion to the amendment to the amendment? Representative Mahoney.
How big is 14-point font?
Almost large enough for you to read without your reading glasses on. The commonly what you would see is 12-point font. Really? Or Representative Murdoch could?
Yes.
Oh. All right. Can anyone explain to Representative Mahoney how large 14-point font is? Representative Loom.
Big enough that I can see it without my cheater reading glasses.
Well,
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
Is that sufficient?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lilly,
if you were to grab your House research sheet, I would mm-hmm. think that the word analyst would be pretty darn close to 14 size font.
Representative Sanders, do you want to weigh in? Last week we spent 20 minutes on Ann versus Orr with the same parties before us. So.
I withdraw my question.
That's based on my 20-some years in newspaper industry. So.
Oh.
Yeah, I would say that's probably important.
Representative Murdoch, I'm told that you could save us some time by simply incorporating my amendment into your amendment. Do you want to do that?
Why not?
Okay, thank you.
With that, Representative Murdoch renews his motion that the A10-2246 amendment, as amended, he just moves the darn thing. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Murdoch, to your bill as amended.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill here, House File 3024, deals with affordable housing in Minnesota, and we started working on this. It's manufactured single-wide homes, actually, and we started working on this bill. Oh gosh, way early summer of last year, and working with Senator Saxhog and Senator Scogin in the Senate, I want to thank. Representative Solberg for signing on right away, showing support. Worked with the Commerce Department, and Commissioner Svegum and Assistant Commissioner Joachim are behind us here. I want to thank them for all the hard work they did. And we do have the full support of the Commerce Department on this bill. And Representative Mahoney had some concerns. We addressed that. That's all taken care of. And Mark Bruner is here from the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and I'll just turn it over to him for a brief explanation so we can go home at noon.
Excellent. Mr. Bruner, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Bruner, the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and I'd like to thank Representative Murdoch for his work on this issue, and it has been something I got involved in this issue, actually, after it was already underway. You had met with some constituents along with Senator Saxhog and Scogin. And what it really comes down to is in federal law, which manufactured homes are built to a federal building code. Minnesota has, we have 8 plants in the state. 5 of them build manufactured homes. The 3 that don't build modular homes. But there's a requirement in federal law that says when a manufactured home is originally installed to the first buyer of the home, the foundation system under the home has to be installed according to what the manufacturer requires in its manual. In addition to that, the federal standard requires today that any new manufactured home has to have a system designed to deal with the effects of frost on a home. So essentially you'd have a frost-free foundation, whether that would be a manufactured home that's a single-section home or a multi-section, which might be two or three sections that are brought together on the home site. Probably 85% of the homes that that we build and sell in Minnesota are sited on real estate with the permanent foundation and financed with a traditional or conforming mortgage. Now, there are other homes, particularly the single-section manufactured homes that may end up in a manufactured home community or on leased land, and some of them do end up on real estate as well. But in those cases, you know, the homes tend to be lower-priced homes as a single section. And the example that was brought to Representative Murdoch and Senator Saxhog are situations where, for example, you may have a $15,000 used manufactured home. Perhaps it's a 10-year-old home. And the way the Minnesota Building Code was drafted, and this was like 30 years ago when these requirements weren't even part of the construction process, the requirement is that if the used manufactured home is relocated, it's required to comply with the original requirements for the home when it was installed. So what that would mean is that a home that may have been, $20,000-$25,000, because it was a new home, it was able to be financed much easier than used manufactured homes are. The lender at that time would have financed the foundation system under the home. When it's a used home and gets relocated, the value, for example, is the $15,000 home. The way the code is written today, that home would still have to have the same frost-free foundation, which would run about $8,000 under the home when it's relocated. Whether the consumer or the buyer of the home wanted to do that or not, it would just because that's just the way the code is written. So the dilemma is for someone that has this $15,000 home that perhaps they're selling to somebody who wants to relocate it because they're purchasing a site-built home or they want to upgrade to a larger manufactured home, that seller ends up losing equity in that they go to that $15,000 that they've got an equity in the home. Essentially for that buyer then to purchase the home and relocate it is going to have to come up with an additional $8,000. So they say to the seller, well, we just can't pay that price for that home because we're going to be putting this $8,000 foundation under the home. The bank won't finance it because perhaps it's going in a manufactured home park where the owner of the home doesn't own the land. So what the bill does in that regard is put in place a notice so that the purchaser of the home could reinstall the used manufactured home on a foundation system that doesn't go below the frost line but still complies with the state building code that does have a provision in it for foundation systems above the frost line.
Representative Mahoney, before we all start,
with that
change
from or in conflict.
Well, Mr. Bruder, that was rhetorical.
So what the bill does is put in place essentially a choice or an option for the buyer of the used manufactured home, in that it requires the seller of the home to give notice to the buyer that the home was originally required to have a frost-free foundation. They're electing not to do that, and that it's recommended that the buyer of the home check annually to make sure that if there are any releveling needs or concerns that be addressed. And it also contains a provision that requires down the road, let's say, for example, that you've got the first purchaser of this used home that has it reinstalled without the frost-free foundation for the home that originally was required to have the frost-free foundation. There's a provision that then says that the seller for any subsequent buyers must disclose to those buyers of the home that the home is not installed on a frost-free foundation, and that the requirement in the bill says that that information is to be included on the purchase agreement. Mm-hmm. So that as the sale process moves along with the home, there's the continuation of the, if you will, of the notice. The Department of Labor and Industry, who is supportive of the bill, and we've been working with the department for several months on crafting language that would work for how they do business, will issue a separate seal. When a manufactured home is installed, it has to be inspected in terms of the installation complying with the state building code. So when the installer, and these installers are licensed by the state, puts this seal on the back of the home, which they're required to do now, the department will essentially issue a different seal so that it's identifiable to the seller and the buyer of the home that it was installed above the frost line.
Excellent. Mr. Brewer, thank you. Does the department wish to testify on any of this at this time? Commissioners indicating no. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3024 as amended? Representative Murdoch, any closing comments?
Well, besides besides protecting the equity these people have in their homes, it's also protecting jobs in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a couple of dealers that sell the modular homes, and it would affect them. They'd have to lay people off. They wouldn't be able to take these homes and trade. And so it's also saving jobs in Minnesota.
Very good. With that, Representative Murdoch renews his motion that House File 3024, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Murdoch, while you are there, would you please move the minutes of our February 26th meeting?
Do I have to move them here to read them, or is it okay to move them from here?
Oh, why don't you just move them from here?
Okay, so moved.
So moved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much. I want to thank the Pages for their assistance this year. Nonpartisan staff, as always, for their humor and expertise. The partisan staff who've served their members, all the members, and, of course, Ms. Murphy and Ms. Faust for keeping us online and moving. We stand adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you.